Welcome to the Evolution Exchange Nordics podcast. At Evolution, we are committed to helping people and Nordic tech organizations realize their true potential. Our goal is to develop deep relationships with individuals, building trust to make doing business easier. I'm Jacob Byerly from Evolution Recruitment Solutions, and today I'll be your host. Today I'm joined by Sunil Subramanian, Ebba Lind, Nima Bustain, and Manish Mishra. Before we delve deeper into the topic, which today will be building and leading high-performing teams, we're going to work our way around the room with some introductions. Of course, for our audio listeners, we'd love to know who you are, what exactly it is you do at your companies, and then perhaps what your biggest passion is currently or something interesting about you. So why don't we start with yourself, Manish? Why don't you introduce yourself?
Hello, everyone. Great to be here. I lead portfolio management team responsible for portfolio and commercial strategy and portfolio governance in one of the business areas in Ericsson. I'm based out of Stockholm, and I'm really looking forward to this discussion.
Perfect. And we'll go to yourself, Nima.
Hi, everyone. So I'm Nima, based out of Stockholm, and I've done a whole lot of engineering, product design, and product management in the past. Currently, I'm at Scania helping the electrification and digitalization journey over here.
Perfect. Yourself, Ebba?
Hi, my name is Ebba Linde, and I'm a senior product manager at Svenska Dagbladet, a big morning newspaper here in Sweden. I'm based in Stockholm and been working in Schibsted for around 10 years in different product roles.
Perfect. And finally, yourself, Sunil.
Hello, everyone. I'm Sunil, working as a product lead in Volvo Cars, mainly working with the volvocars.com. And what we basically do is undergoing a digital transformation to see how we can sell premium cars online. Quite a fascinating field. And with all the autonomous cars coming up, I feel it's quite an exciting place to be. And apart from work, I also do a lot of mentorship, training people, because that was something I missed when I was trying to get into product. So basically, from a QA background, I was trying to get into a product, and I felt that mentorship is something that can actually help people. Even though it's only a few minutes of your time, it can be a life-changing experience for the other person. Looking forward for this discussion. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Sunil.
Hi, everyone. This is Chris Bennett here, the Nordics Managing Director here at Evolution. We're committed to doing recruitment in a different way that adds value to both our clients and candidates by providing you with amazing speakers and leading-edge discussions on what's going on in the tech scene at the moment. There are three reasons why you should contact me. If you would like to speak on a future podcast, if you are interested in hiring awesome tech, data, product or gaming freelancers for your business, or if you are looking for an exciting new organization to work with, please get in touch. Thank you so much for listening, and I really hope to hear from you soon. Please enjoy the rest of the podcast.
So I guess now that we've established a context to each of you, we'll move on to the topic in focus. You've all obviously prepared a question, some sub-questions and some statements on building and leading high-performing teams. As usual on these podcast formats, I'll sort of work my way around the room, ask each of you to pose your questions, and then give us a little bit of a reasoning as to why you have chosen this question, give us a little bit of an answer, and of course we open it up to the room for a discussion or debate. Why don't we start with yourself, Manish? The question you've brought today is the fact that a leader is going to be pulled in many different and sometimes conflicting directions. I guess you're going to share what works best for yourself in how to prioritize how you spend your time, and also help the team to make those decisions. So why don't you start us off?
Right. Why I chose this question is because most of us leaders get this sort of problem to solve on a daily basis. You know, there's always short of time, and there are always competing priorities looking for our attention, and not only ours, I think our team's attention. And this is so relevant in this kind of a dynamic, not only the dynamic tech business environment, but the overall economic and geopolitical environment that we live in. It's very essential to prioritize, right? So I will So of course, I'm going to share my experiences of what seemed to have worked for me. And I will share that in two dimensions. So the first dimension is about the team and as a leader, right? So I think the most important thing to be able to prioritize well is to be very clear on the direction or the strategic direction or what we want to achieve. What is the goal that we are after, right? And that is, of course, the most important job of the leadership. When we are successful in keeping a clear strategic direction, that's when we succeed. That has been my experience. So which in practical sense has meant for me and my teams that we need to be very clear on the objectives and key results. We follow a framework called OKRs, or objectives and key results, which means we set up an ambitious objective for that year, but then we are also very concrete on what are the sort of key results that we are looking after for that quarter. So we work on that, and when we are very clear on what we want to achieve, it's easy for us, so as a leader, to prioritize your time, you know, time towards customers, time towards products, time towards teams. I think it's very clear on what we need to prioritize. And then you can filter out the things that you don't want to do as well, right? But then it's also important to communicate it fiercely to the teams. You know, it's very important to communicate the OKRs very clearly to the teams, so they are also very clear on and nobody can change their path, so they're very clear on what to prioritize. So that's a little bit about the first dimension, the leadership and the teams. Be very clear on what is the most important things, and then believe on the organization that they will choose the right steps. The second thing is a little bit about how I personally deal with this. So I have found that I have spent time mostly in three areas. So customer dimension, so products and services, product roadmaps. So that's a dimension where we do a lot of work with technical teams and all that. But then there is a customer dimension. So bouncing the requirements, bouncing both what are their pain points and what is our strategy with the customers. And the third is with the team. So I believe in sort of spending equal amount of time in all the three dimensions. Customers are always sort of top priority, when there is an escalation or when there is a problem to solve, they normally take priority. But I do want to make sure that I give each of these three areas equal attention as much as I can. So that's how I think it has worked for me.
Perfect, thank you. And does anybody else want to sort of maybe add an opinion or a method of how they operate the same?
Absolutely, I would agree with most of what Manish was mentioning. And another interesting aspect, probably from my experience, that I would like to add is the vision part. As long as you have a good vision that ties with what the company wants to achieve, that's where the real success metrics lies. So most of the time, what happens was, even though we feel that our team is empowered, but suddenly there might be one stakeholder who is wishing to add a feature that he thinks that might contribute to the benefit of the customer. So how does, as a product leader, you understand the stakeholder and also use data to do some more experimentation to show what the real value we are trying to provide, and trying to use that as a discussion point? So there is always this famous saying that data beats argument. So that can be used, or that should be used by a leader to make a wise decision before implementing any kind of a feature. So that is one thing that came out of my experience. The other thing I would say is each individual developer who is working with your team should also be empowered, aligned, and also be quite autonomous. Which means autonomous means it doesn't mean that they don't speak with each other. It means that they have a sense of control where they can solve the problem among themselves instead of it reaching to a level higher. So that is really important. And to make that happen, each of our team members also needs to understand the holistic vision of what our company wants to do and what our product area wants to do. So that's where these OKRs come in. As long as you communicate the goal very clear to a developer on how a small picture of his working is contributing to a larger frame, that can give a sense of vision for him, as well as an understanding and also a sense of accomplishment when something what he does is contributing to the overall vision of the company. So yeah, those were the points I thought of mentioning, Jacob.
Thank you for sharing that, Sunil. And also, I really think what you said there, Misha, was interesting about that you need to really clearly communicate your OKRs. I think that there's a strong like repeat value in talking about your OKRs, that your OKRs should not be something that you set in the start of the quarter, and then when the period starts to end, you look at it and like, oh, what did we achieve? But I think that if OKRs is supposed to give you value, it's something that you need to work with actively. So I think that the one way of not drifting away and losing focus, that was your kind of your initial starting point, I think, like by having rituals in your team where OKRs kind of get some attention, makes you stay focused on like, are we actually working on what we said was important? So kind of finding time to work with your OKRs continuously, I think is an important dimension. And then what you talked about there, Sunil, about stakeholders, I think that when you set up your OKRs, it's really important to get both your team and your stakeholders involved in the actual outcome of the OKRs, that it's not something that you just set and say, this is what we're going to work on, but that you really make sure that you have buy-in and that you give room for your stakeholders to actually challenge your priorities. That it's not just something that, oh, this is what we're going to do and no discussion, but please invite for a little discussion around it, so that when you set your OKRs, everybody, like your top management or your most important partners or stakeholders and the team, are on board on that journey. I think that's an important angle of that. Very interesting question, Misha.
Yeah, so I, when speaking of leadership, I always think of this blog post I read about SpaceX, which is they were interviewing some engineer that was creating a small, I think, like piece of hardware for the launch pad. And they were asking him, you know, why are you creating this piece of hardware? And he could basically like recite the steps it would take and, you know, why this specific piece of cogwheel would help them reach their goal, which was being on Mars, right? So landing on Mars in like 10 years, I'm creating this piece of hardware to help the launch pad, and then the launch pad, you know, sets up the rocket, and then the rocket goes to space, and then hopefully you colonize Mars. And what's important about that is like the storytelling around it, I think, makes it very powerful. So I've been in organizations that are very KPI and OKR driven, and sometimes personally I feel like there's no why, you know, you feel like kind of a rat running around chasing these numbers, but you don't really know why you're doing it. But having OKRs along with the storytelling and the very, you know, passionate leader who can stand on a scene and actually tell you, you know, why you're on this mission together, I feel like is the best combination.
I think you're onto something super important there, Nima, that kind of your OKR needs to come with a package, kind of the because I've been working with OKRs for several years, and it's impossible to get people like thrilled about a fancy, super well defined objective. But if you can put that in a context, that starts that can make people more engaged. But like, the only the story will make it hard for people to approach it. Only the OKRs will make it maybe not so inspiring. So I'm 100% agree with you that kind of the vision, the product strategy, and the kind of the big important transformation that you need to do, that's super important as a complement.
Perfect. And I guess that actually really leads us nicely on to your question, Ebba, which is almost about, you know, the storytelling, but also very much about the collaboration within the team and trusting your fellow team members as well as your manager, or in your guys's case your direct reports. So Ebba, you've brought to the panel the question of why will teams with this lack of trust most likely fail, or why is, you know, trust the most important driver of a high performing team? So I guess, why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, why you chose to bring this question, number one, and of course, leading on from the last question, give us a bit of an answer.
Thank you for inviting me to talk about that. And so why did I pick trust as the most important driver of a high performing team? I think that within a team or within an organization or with a cross-functional team, if there's no trust, if there's no psychological safety, you will have very little chances of succeeding. And why am I saying that? It's because if there's no trust, it will be very hard to challenge each other. But if you trust each other, you can challenge things to find the best priorities, the best solutions, really make sure that everyone understands the strategic direction that you're heading towards. And if there's trust, you can even challenge things that are complicated or that are political or that are a bit emotional. So I think that establishing that trust part gives room for challenging, which leads you to the best solution. And also, if people can challenge, they can get more involved in the solution. So if the team can feel safe to like talk about that, why are we solving this in this way? Why are we doing that? They can also get engaged in the solution, and kind of the outcome will be driven from the organization. It will not be driven by someone hunting KPIs and saying like, how is it going with this? But it's actually driven from within the organization. And also, I mean, having a psychological safety or trust in a team makes people kind of feel good. And I think that people that feel like the people that are happy and that are feel comfortable at work will deliver and do like will perform in this context. And what I can just add that I think that there are three or there are many drivers of how you can create trust in a team, but three things that I think are important is that, like, firstly, you need to take time to celebrate achievements and also frame your failures as learnings, not mistakes. Kind of have a culture where you're like, yes, we did well, wow, we reached this milestone, but also we didn't reach this milestone, we did this launch and it was a great failure, but what did we learn from it? That you kind of, you know, you celebrate your success and you celebrate your failures as something that you learn from, and having that kind of learning culture and celebrating culture, I think that it's great for team trust, because if you can achieve things together, you will trust each other. And also, I think that in a team, in order to establish trust, you need to make room for fun and personality. Like, by letting some of your meetings not being super strict on agenda, you can get like that fun and cheerful conversation going. For example, at Svenska Dagbladet, we start all our stand-ups with a fun and quirky question, just to get like, you know, a little fun. Like it can be seen as kind of waste of time talking about a strange question on what kind of flower you would like to be if you were a flower. But it makes people talk and gives a fun start of the day. We also have like 45 minutes lean coffee every second week where we talk about whatever. It's like, it's not work related. It could be like, what kind of movies would you like to go to? Or it's like just a conversation where we get to know each other and an inclusive forum where everybody can feel involved. And like having those kind of, you know, less agenda strict conversations make people laugh together, have fun, get to know each other. And that creates a great foundational trust. And lastly, I think that one thing that really gives trust in a team is that you can learn from each other. That like, if you have a culture in your team where you share, like, okay, I know I have this great thought I would like to share with you guys. And if that's perceived that, oh, that's a great, that's something really interesting, I didn't know that. It's a kind of, you know, that you can learn from each other, and that people don't try to be kind of the smartest person in the room, but you can actually admit like, oh, this is a knowledge gap of me. I need to learn more about this. Please help me. Please talk. Please tell me more about that. That you can give room in a team culture to learn from each other and to learn new stuff. I think that's also an important driver of trust. So that's my my reflections, I think.
Yeah, maybe I can go next on this topic. Very interesting topic. I think it is actually fundamental of any teams, any successful team. So I will probably reiterate some of the things that you said. Without trust, there will be no speak up. without trust, people will be worrying a lot to fail, and no innovation will happen. They don't help each other. A lot of collaboration will not happen. So a lot of discussion that we are going to have in this call will not happen if there is not there's no trust in between the teams, right? So it is absolutely essential. So I will talk about three dimensions of it in from my experience. So the first is, as you mentioned, about psychological safety, right? So can people speak up? Are they too much worried about failing? Do we learn from failure and are able to fail? These are the things that we understand, right? So when we have a psychological safety in the team, so there is a trust between the people, that team can do all these good stuff that we talked about. But the second aspect is more practical towards product flow. You know, the lead time. If you look at, there was one of the leaders in our organization. I worked with him. He led that work. We set up a very extensive work on improving trust across the organization, and he was leading that. There's a very good term that he floated, he talked about big fat doormen. And these big fat doormen are people who push for handovers, you know, handovers between development to operations, handovers between product management to development, handovers between sales to product management. All these handovers, there's a big fat doorman sitting there with their big checklist, right? So the question is, do we want control or do we want trust? It is a lot of data suggests that there's a significant improvement in lead time and time to market and all that when you actually build this product flow on trust rather than when you build it on these controls and big fat doormen, right? So that's the second aspect. You can improve a lot of this by using that. But then the third dimension is, in my experience, is that trust also builds when you and your team are having the right skills and competencies so that people trust you. So our product management team will be trusted when they actually can deliver on what they are committed. Similarly, an R&D or a development organization will be trusted when they can do their. So the third aspect is also to keep looking at your skills and competencies so that people can trust you. So you build trust. The trust needs to be built. It's like you work on a bank account with others, right? So I think those three dimensions have been very important practically for building trust in my experience.
Probably I can also add on here. So what, according to me, is trust is what the other team does without watching. So it's basically you trust them, so they deliver what they intend to without you focusing on whether they are doing it or checking their progress. So that's how great teams are being developed in the organizations. And Eba and Manish mentioned, I also agree to a lot of points. So how do you build this trust is one of the first and the foremost thing that you need to do whenever you set up the team. Speak with the different people, understand what they think about the team and what they think about each other, what is the burning point they have. And usually these kind of discussions don't come out in a bigger forum. It comes up only when you have a frank one-on-one or a friendly discussions with your team member, or use a platform like Office Vibe where you get this anonymous feedback. So one of the key thing that you need to act on to establish this trust is also the retrospectives, which is very, very essential. Most of the time, what different companies do is they are quite busy building the product. They don't take time to do the retrospective. They feel it's an unnecessary waste of time. But the most important points of establishing trust and understanding what the weaknesses of the team comes from retrospective. So it's like you cannot keep on cutting the trees, right? You need to also pause on for a while to sharpen your axe. So I feel that trust can actually enable enable the teams to do magical things. So I feel every organization needs to take a point to ensure that they have a highly trusted team. And the other aspect I also want to touch upon is the trust you have with the senior management. So most of the time, what happens is either it's a top-down or a bottom-up approach. And in most of the companies, we follow what the leaders say. But it should be the other way around. The leaders also needs to hear on what happens in the ground level, understand on what is working out with the team level, encourage the ideas in the form of hackathon. So all the great ideas can also emerge from the bottom. It's not that everything comes from the top. And Volo has been really good in doing that, especially conducting hackathon to have this product-driven culture where the new ideas emerge and then we take a stab at it to see how we can handle it together to solve the major user problem. And that also works for the business. So to have all of it, you need to have trust. So that is one of the key factors, according to my opinion.
Perfect. And Nima, I mean, in your personal opinion, when you're within your teams and you're running them, how would you say that you utilize, you know, trust and this camaraderie amongst your team to be productive and to have a high performing team?
I think where it starts in the most productive teams I've been in is it starts with the hiring process, and you make sure that you hire people with like the same core beliefs, right? It could be that the core belief is that a business should be product led. It should be, you know, obsessed with the customer and so on and so forth. That's kind of one way of being productive. But another way of also like not really trust related, but being productive is you need to have a leader who's kind of worked themselves up. So having, you know, this maybe MBA person coming down and being a product leader by appointment is often less productive than having someone who has kind of worked themselves up to a product position, whether this be, you know, from other disciplines or whether this be just by, you know, sheer amount of years in the business. So that also builds trust and kind of this two-way communication so that, you know, people in the team can trust your opinion, but you can also give relevant input down to your team instead of just, you know, doing people management. So those are two things that I would also focus on.
I think that this thing you said about the kind of principles or it's really, really important, and kind of maybe not everybody have the same principles that but at least that you have a discussion around them. And the kind of that you know what principles are important for you and your team. But I also think one thing about a trust is that there's a lot about like making others trust you as a product manager, as a product leader, that others trust your team to deliver and that you can set up a strategy. But there's also like trust is a mutual thing. And I think it's really important that you as a product manager, product leader, trust your surrounding. You need to you need to trust your stakeholders that they will like, you know, need to understand them and their competences in order for to be able to include them correctly in your priorities. And I know that I once found myself in a situation where one peer, I was like, I felt like, oh, this person is like constantly nagging on my scope, or this person is like challenged me all the time. And I thought like, oh my God, this person don't trust me. I need to really show this person that I can be trusted. But then I went to one of my mentors and I kind of, you know, complained maybe a little about the situation. I said, it's so hard, this person don't trust me. And then my mentor said like, but do you trust this person? And then I start reflecting, oh, maybe I don't. And then I realized that the part of the, like part of the problem why it was hard to kind of create magic together was because I was not giving enough time to get to know this person and kind of work on those important dimensions to create trust. I mean, I think that in that situation, like, you know, celebrating achievements together with this person, having fun or like giving room for personality or learn from that person would probably increase my chances of trusting that person and our collaboration would have been better. So I think it's really important that you as a product leader find that trust with your surrounding as well, not only working on others trusting you.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for bringing that question to the table, Eva. I feel like that one sparked up some real debate there. And I guess it kind of, again, leads us quite nicely on to Sunil, your question. Of course, you've sort of posed the question of how you should empower a team, right? But Eva's told us that she takes bi-weekly fikas breaks with her team and does team building activities and so on and so forth. Is there a different way that perhaps you use it in your current role that you would empower a team differently, or maybe you have a different technique?
Absolutely, Jacob. That's the interesting thought I had, because to have a successful organization, you need to have more of an empowered team. So that was also one thing I was reading about Apple. How did they have more successful products than any other company on the earth? It's all about empowered team, and each of the divisions they have, right, are owned by a single person who takes care of that, like a head of marketing, head of iOS, and everything is quite centric. And the amount of decisions they make in the top management is very, very effective, where they gather for 3 hours in a room to discuss about every aspect of the products that Apple is making. And then that gets trickled down to all kind of decision making that happens within the company. Was the reason for the true success of a company of such huge size. So when in one interview, when one interviewer was asking about Steve Jobs, how are you running such a big company? He said, obviously, this is one of the biggest startup on earth, where every department is an own startup of its own. So that was the reason why Apple was coming up with such an innovative product. So with the same thought carried forward, I would say that in order to have an empowered team, it's all about having the team understand the vision, like I mentioned before, and also to encourage them in such a fashion that they feel more passionate to solve a problem. So most of the time what happens is we fall in love with a solution rather than a problem. Once we start understanding the problem, already we get into this kind of a solution mode, trying to solve it rather than understand how is it going to benefit the customer. So everyone's mindset in the team, irrespective of whatever their role is, needs to understand how can they contribute to solve the problem that the customer has. When someone or when the team has started getting such kind of a mindset, that's when the empowered team culture begins, where everyone's idea is equally encouraged by each other, and then the team is on its own flow to solve a problem. And that the team also steps out beyond their boundaries by reaching out to help other team to solve the problem, rather than just thinking that, okay, now our problem or solution is done, then we hand over to the other team to solve it. It does not work like that. It's all about who makes an extra effort to solve the end-to-end problem is the team that actually succeeds. And I feel that's the kind of a mindset that that I try to bring in my team whenever we have this general discussions or kind of a team event, or kind of a quarterly meetups, because whenever we meet, then we discuss more on how we are solving the problem for other teams as well. So that is an equal essence of building an empowered team, according to my opinion.
Yeah, maybe I can add to what you said. And I will be talking about things that we have already discussed, but let me structure it in a way, because these are all interrelated, isn't it, what we're talking about. So empowered teams absolutely begins with a strategic direction that is clear to everyone. So vision, a product vision, vision of the whole organization has to be very clear what we want to achieve. And because that gives them a clear direction, so everybody knows where we are going. And then the leader has the responsibility to give the flexibility to the team, the flexibility to work on their own terms, work how they want to deliver. You know, there's a lot of things that comes into that. But with flexibility, of course, we have clearly seen that the accountability has to be very clear, right? So the leader is not micromanaging, but then we come to OKRs, right? The goals and the quantitative key results, the accountability is very clear what people have to deliver. So they are very clear themselves, and the team is clear about that. So vision, flexibility, and accountability is so important for the empowered teams. And then I think then we start talking about how you talked about that, Sunil, that how Apple delivered the products. So I think when you give this flexibility and accountability, that brings in culture of culture where people can challenge each other, the culture where there is no you learn from failures, you share the learnings with each other, that there are no hidden secrets. I think those all cultures start building up when you start empowering the team, so everything comes together. So this all is important to get a fully empowered team in place.
I agree, and I also think what you said there, Sunil, about gathering your team to talk about how your team can help other teams. I think that's a really interesting angle that I think is relevant both in the trust dimension that I mentioned before, but also how you can, like, if your team can show that you are actually up there to help others, it will give you mandate to solve your problems. And I also think that there's an important dimension in empowered teams that referring what you said, Nima, in the recruitment process, you need to have competences in your team that actually can earn that. Like if you have competences that know their domain and can actually deliver a solution, then you will probably be able to work as an empowered team. But if you don't have the competences, or if you're a product team but you don't have any UXers in your team, you're not complete, and you will not be able to be 100% empowered team. But I also think it's important as a product development team that you understand your business, you understand your users, and you understand your business. And if you do that, you will be able to take decisions in your daily work that can lead you to working empowered. You don't have to ask someone like, okay, but what is actually our business KPI, or what is actually important to you? If you as a product team with like engineers, UX, and product people understand your users and your business, and have the competences, you have a great foundation of having being an empowered team, I think. And then lastly, I think communication is really important, that actually you're not just like very good in solving problems, you can actually communicate on why this is the best solution for different diverse groups of people.
And finally, yourself, Nima, have you got any opinions, or have you got any maybe top tips that you'd like to share with everybody about how you would choose to empower a team? Anything different to what's already been said?
I think it's all been pretty spot on, actually. I think one thing that I've come to realize after, you know, many years in the business is that not only is it about the competence, but also some people just want you to be there for them emotionally. So not just, you know, being able to draw some architecture on a whiteboard or some wireframe, but just, you know, noticing if they're feeling down, or doing a one-to-one where you don't talk work, you just talk, I don't know, what happened this weekend, or what are you going to do the next weekend, or for summer break. I think those types of relationships also kind of tend to build trust and productivity over time. So not only focusing on, you know, work-related stuff, but also kind of created those bonds between people.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And I mean, I kind of leads us, I mean, not as maybe as fluid, but we talked about Apple at the beginning from Sunil, and he talked about how their product teams work and how they plan on empowering. I guess, Nima, the question that you've brought to the panel is talking about these USA product teams compared to the product teams out of Europe. You compared them both, and you believe, or you think, that the US global success in product teams is better, perhaps, or more successful out of the US than Europe. Why do you think that?
Yeah, so I guess this is just... I don't have an answer, so this is a question for, you know, for the others in this podcast, which is, you know, when you look at America or California, for instance, you know, there's a lot of successful international products being rolled out. Also, when you look at China, when you look at India, what I've heard, you know, from people there is that basically they're pretty much relentless in terms of product development, meaning they don't look at the product team as a family. They look at it as a sports team. So you only want the best people. They should only strive to, you know, become billionaires, all of them. They should only work 24/7. And that's the way you achieve success as a product team. And in some continents, that kind of seems to work, right? But in Europe, we might not have that culture. Maybe in startups, but not in larger organizations. And, you know, seeing as you guys are from larger organizations, I'd like to basically ask you guys, you know, where do you think, what differentiates Europe from India, China, and America? Is it that work ethic? Is it us maybe treating each other more as family than as sports teams? Is it us not, you know, wanting to achieve that billion, instead it's about a million? Like, where do you think that different lies?
I mean, I can try to go second, and we probably do not have an American on the panel to actually talk about what is successful there, right? But we all have friends, and we have sometimes worked in the Valley, so we know a little bit about that. So the first thing I would like to state, though, is that I do not think that European companies are lagging in innovation or creativity, right? I think Europe has been a center of innovation and creativity for a very long time. Cultural creativity, you know, science. I think Renaissance, or that sort of came up here, right? So your question is actually quite deep than what it looks, to be honest. So, but then what I would state is that the US has many things going for it. I think the most important thing is diversity, and the fact that they have been fortunate enough to have one of the best people from all over the globe, different countries going to their places, especially the Valley, to build these new companies that you see. So that diversity, in my experience, a diverse team has most of the times innovated better, because they come up with different alternatives that you can't think on your own. You know, you have a direction of thought, and someone from a different culture, someone from a different background can think in a much different way, and there are different options too. So diversity is one of the things. But of course, there are other things like the culture there. The culture of importance of capital is so important. The respect of capital and the right infrastructure and regulations to use capital well is probably that has helped the US. I wouldn't say that the cutthroat competition or that kind of a culture has helped them, because if you see the best companies, there the culture is better than many others. We spoke about Apple, right? I think it's one of the best companies to work for as well, in a lot of ways, and it's not really known for its cutthroat competition. So in summary, I think very few people actually have the right answer, but there is a sauce, the secret sauce in the US, which helps them continue to innovate. And by the way, it's not all the US, right? It's specific parts of the US which is able to do that, not all the US.
I can just add on that I thought that was a really wise answer to that tricky question, Misha, because I think that when you said that, Nima, like, why are US companies' product teams better than Europeans? I think there's like a little friction in that. Like, is it really so? I agree that the answer to that one is really complex. But I think that what you said there, that building, like being able to build, having a great pool of competences and being actually able to build diverse teams is probably a key driver. And I also think that what you said there, Misha, about like the teams that the companies that succeed, they're actually focusing on that culture and building. So I guess that that kind of having a great culture, I mean, in Scandinavia or in Europe, I mean, in Scandinavia or in Sweden, we focus a lot on having a great culture at work. So I think that there's also that's a strength on our end, and that but probably that pool of competences, and also what you said about capital is in the US in the US winning pool. But it is a complicated, it's a little friction question. I like
that. Probably I can also add my view. Very, very interesting question, Nima, because this was also something that has been ongoing on my mind. And when I was speaking with a few of my network in US, and also on what is exactly happening in the Silicon Valley, the real reason is the surplus amount of talent there and the enormous opportunities, especially in terms of the companies that also add to what Steve Jobs used to call it as a beehive effect. So most of what happens is if you are working in an established company, then if there is a startup with a pool of venture capitalism that's coming in, so you will be picked up to work on the startup. And even if that fails, then you go back to your old company or any other big company. So the kind of cumulative effort is something that has resulted in Silicon Valley's enormous opportunities that provided the base for US. But another reflection, at least from my opinion, is that the rolling, sometimes what happens is most of the roles what I see in Europe is called as a product owner, not a product manager. So product owner is actually a role within a framework, not exactly what the product manager does. So probably that kind of a mindset shift is also something we need, because most of the people think that if they just go attend a course on CSPO and take that certification, they can become a product owner. But that's not the case. The real thing that we need to have is also the cultural mindset on what's the difference between a product owner and a product manager, and how those big companies can evolve to have more product managers who can try to bring up new ideas and solve the customer problems. Will be the most successful companies. That's the kind of a mindset that Europe needs to have, is my opinion. Europe has a really strong innovation and R&D capability. It's all about how do we capitalize on this innovation is something that they need to think through, is my opinion. Because Sweden is one of the most innovative countries in the world. And I feel now with the Stockholm emerging as with a lot of startups, I feel the culture of Europe is also changing in a very positive note. And I'm very sure that Stockholm is going to emerge as one of Silicon Valley of Europe in the coming years.
And
so I also think there's something around the US, around the concentration and the fast adaption of new technology, like for example AI, that it feels like with so many promoters in such a little, like if you look at Silicon Valley, there's like AI, I've not been there, but I, for example, I listened to we have a tech podcast here at Svenska Dagbladet, Tech Brief, and there a guy talked about kind of how it is in Silicon Valley that like AI is everywhere. It's like it's in every company. It's on like you can find a little sign on the street saying like, oh, by the way, we need someone working with AI. It's like it's about that hype and that like huge penetration of a new technology that I also think that maybe we can learn from in Scandinavia, kind of, and also kind of that the US has, like that Silicon Valley has good conditions for, like that they have so many, like they can really go all in on the new technology, or like with the race of VR, and that like kind of new technologies tend to be launched in markets like in US, for example. Like if we want to explore with the new VR headsets, they're not even like live here in Scandinavia, so we will lag after on that. So kind of that new functionalities and features are launched in the US firstly is also one thing.
Absolutely. And I guess before we wrap it up, I thought that Manish would come back to just one or more of the questions that you've actually brought to the panel, because I thought it did just lead on so nicely. Obviously, with the Silicon Valley, the level of innovation there, obviously your role at Ericsson at the moment is sort of very largely orientated around innovation and bringing almost the Scandinavian market back up to speed in comparison to perhaps the rest of the world. Not saying it isn't, but just to obviously relate it to the last question, obviously with your role, innovation in both product and services is central to success. But how is it that you are like doing things differently, and what is your process towards innovation that's allowing yourself, your team, and Ericsson to catch up to the rest of the world?
Right. Innovation. I think what I will just talk about is the practical parts of what I think makes innovation work, because I do believe that this is something that that can be built in teams, right? It is teams can build the culture of building new things, and innovation is probably like transformation. Innovation is probably one of the most abused buzzwords also. But what works is that the first thing is that I think everyone in the team, including the leader, needs to have full focus on the pain points they're solving. I think that is, they need to fully understand that what is the problem that is being solved from either the product or the service, fully understand the customer journey, and identify the users of the service or the product, and fully understand what is the journey that they're following. following which parts of the journey, customer journey that we are solving. So the pain points has to be very, very clear. Then I think the second thing which has worked is, we have talked about that quite a bit, is a speak up culture. Speak up culture and diversity, they go together, right? And which means that you are encouraging different points of view to come out, so that you always look at different alternatives, and you're not only looking at one direction of thought, that also delivers new options to work on. Then I think the other thing that has worked is experimentation mindsets. So lean is, we have all read all the literature and the body of knowledge about lean, and you have to implement that very clearly on the full flow of your product. So not only with development and operations, the whole flow between product management to development to operations, including sales, must have a lean mindset. So you should be able to experiment. So you should be able to create MVPs where you solve a particular problem of the user, and then read and then validate that with the users. So you don't spend sort of 10 million on a big product which nobody needs. You build something small and validate it with the user and then build on the product. Finally, I would say, again, something that we have spoken about, but keeping outcomes at the front and center of your discussions. A lot of times teams are, and we have all done that, teams are doing unnecessary discussions on this methodology, that framework, that process, and we do a lot of these fights between different frameworks, methodologies, and all that. That unnecessary discussion will go away when you start focusing on the outcome. Because then you realize that you probably need good things from all the methodologies to be able to drive the success of the products or the service, and you can build new things, right? So those will be my those are my practical experiences coming out from.
Thank you for sharing, and I think that's a really like how to create good processes for innovation. That's such a really hard nut to crack. So kind of sharing experiences on this topic is super relevant. And I agree with all the topics you said. And I think that one dimension as well, working with innovation, is allowing time to look outside of your bubble. It sounds trivial, but kind of, just allocating time for your team to work on things that will get your mind going, I think, is really important. We in Whole Shipstead Media, in the product and tech community, we have 10% day every second Friday. We wipe our calendars and we, work on something that is kind of outside our main scope, just to learn something new or to, work on a project that is close to heart. And I think that kind of allowing time where creativity flows will put added value to those really great and structured processes. So for me, myself, for example, I try to use my 10% day when I manage to prioritize them. I try to prioritize them to kind of, read about what's happening in the industry and our market, and then try to share that with my team to give new perspective of what's happening. So kind of look outside your bubble and try to implement that in your daily work is important, I think, in order to create innovation.
Thank you, Heba, for nicely summing it up. And according to me, innovation happens when different people come together. That's where people thrive and the innovation happens. And when you have that kind of a people in your organization, then creativity obviously emerges from these people's interaction. And then inspiration comes from this intensive concentration when people work together. So when people start experimenting, iterating, discussing, and then they also debate about it, and then trying and retrying again and again, that's how they bring in innovative products that solves customer problem. And any idea, whatever the team has, you need to validate within a 2-week window. Otherwise, we fall more in love with that idea and that we won't progress. So it's all about trying out an idea within 2 weeks, especially with a form of a low fidelity or a high fidelity prototype, trying to validate the hypothesis like Manish was mentioning, rather than building it to test it out. Try it out to see what whether the customer will like it and then start building it. And also it's a good idea to have hackathons once in a while, like Abba was mentioning, clear out the entire calendar day, work with different ideas, because that's when you try a lot of good ideas in a very short time and ensure that this could be a kind of a value addition to the product you're building. So that is something that has worked out really well within our product cluster in Volvo. And I feel that every company should have at least one hackathon happening every quarter or once in every 2 months.
Perfect. If there was nothing that anybody wanted to add on to that, then I guess we can nicely wrap up the pod. Just before we end the podcast, I'd obviously like to thank so much to all of our guests for their thoughts. Once again, we've had Nima Bustanian, we've had Ebba Lind, we've had Manish Mishra, and we've had Sunil Subramanian. I'm sure if an audio listener has a question for any of the panel members today, then they won't mind you shooting them a message on LinkedIn. If you are hiring for new technical roles or looking for a new role, feel free to get in touch with us here at Evolution. Or if you or anyone you know would like to be featured on a future podcast, you can drop me a message too. Once again, I'm Jacob Biley, and you can find me on LinkedIn, or you can email me at jacob.biley@evolution-nordics.com, or visit us at evolutionjobs.com/nordics. Thanks again to all of our guests, and thank you so much at home for listening. We hope you can join us again next time.